At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Journalism is still sixth. He's got a lot of ground to cover. He is still five lengths behind as they make their way toward the top of the stretch. Gosker trying to pull off a huge upset here. Has taken the lead on the outside. Clever again cuts the corner. Journalism is getting closer now. He's behind a wall of horses. He's looking for a place to go. And he's got nowhere to go. Oh, he bumped hard. Bumped hard with Goal Oriented. In the meanwhile, Gosker's running the race of his life. And Sandman has entered the scene. And he has moved up on the far outside. Journalism is still running on. He's back into second. He might even win it. Here's the wire. Oh, my goodness. Journalism has won the Preakness Stakes in a performance like you read about.
Greetings, sports fans. We are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Gino. I'm here with Darren. Here with Kevin. Today, Tuesday, May 20th, is episode 170. Please catch us wherever you get your podcasts. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, follow us on YouTube, Instagram. We're all over the place right now. Give us a look. Join our pages. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to send us some comments, we'll be sure to get back to you. We go around the world of sports tonight, including the NHL playoffs, the Preakness, the PGA Championship, the NBA, where the Knicks have advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals after beating Boston in Game 6 at Madison Square Garden. First time in 25 years that they have made it this far. They played a complete game. We'll get into it. They were up 27 at the half, wound up winning by 38. This was just the dominant performance you want to see when you're trying to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. Kev, let's start it out with the Knicks.
Yeah, Game 6 was just incredible. They put their foot on the throat. They got up 20-plus at halftime. And Boston, and I'm not saying this, I know a lot of times you hear this term and it's in a bad way. The Celtics quit the second half of Game 6. I'm not saying, and I'm not using that. I know you've heard of teams quitting in a different way. I'm not trying to bash them for quitting. They knew they were done.
Yeah, down 27 at the half, I think, you're down in the series. You lost the 27. Best player. I mean,
Tatum's out. Brown, after the season, you realize that, he's been playing on a torn meniscus for the last month. I mean, they knew they were done. Absolutely. That's how I mean quitting, not quitting out of a negative connotation. Yep. They knew they were done. That was it. And the Knicks were able to coast. And kudos to them for taking care of business, not fooling around, not somehow choking away and all of a sudden you're staring at Game 7 in Boston that, no, they did what they had to do. Great job. And, now they're meeting the Pacers. And this series is up for grabs.
Yeah.
Darren, what did you think of Game 6 first?
It wasn't really – like you said, the quitting thing is an interesting way to put it because it's true. They just knew they were done. And they just knew that they could not come back from it. Brown, they played him with the 5 fouls in the third quarter. They let him foul out. They were like, there's no reason not to. White was the only guy that seemed to really come to play for the most part. And you see the difference in the Knicks team when Cat comes out aggressively.
Yeah,
when he comes out aggressively, the team has a totally different dynamic. Ananobi, who kind of came on a little bit toward the end of the game, had an awful start of this game. And, Bridges, as usual, hit or miss early, and then he starts getting hotter. And Hart's all over the place. And Brunson's Brunson. But when Cat kind of gets things going on the offensive side of the floor, it gives the Knicks a dimension that is going to be hard to match by most teams. I'm not saying that they are head and shoulders above OKC or Minnesota or even Indianapolis with it. Indiana, I should say. But at the same time, you just felt when once Cat was engaged, it was kind of there's no answer. I liked
what I saw with Robinson and McBride playing well, playing really good defensively, giving this team more players other than just the five straight up. Again, I don't want to dig because they're up 27 at the half and 38 to win the game, right? So I don't want to kill them too much, but we still could have played more guys at the end of this bench we got to the end.
Even though he had a week.
I know.
You knew he had 5 days off, but I agree with you. At the 6 minute mark, all that could happen is a sprained ankle.
Yeah,
it's like, come on, get him out of there. A hurt knee.
I don't need to see Towns turn an ankle in the fourth quarter, for no reason, especially when you're up this big. At one point it was 44. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
Yeah. That's what you're afraid of is more the injury aspect.
Yeah.
No, it really wasn't much of a contest. And unfortunately for the NBA, every game seven or deciding game, most of them, if not almost all of them, have been so anticlimactic that there's been nothing really to be glued for. I mean, we'll get into the West in a little while. Yeah. But this, because your team's winning, you're actually somewhat enjoying it, relaxed. But if you're the rest of the country, you're like, I'm turning this game off.
This is boring.
Boston has no shot. Porzingis, who I thought could be a unicorn in the series, showed nothing. And, why waste my time? Why waste another 2 hours watching a bunch of teams just shoot threes for the sake of shooting threes? I can't imagine that. And the market's left. I can't imagine the NBA is thrilled. Thank God they got the Knicks.
We'll put honestly, that's the saving grace from a TV perspective. Fan interest perspective, at least they got one big market involved,
Exactly.
So they go on, they're going to face the Pacers, series starts tomorrow. They played really well. Halliburton looks like he's come on. They took out Cleveland in five games, so it's not like, they've dragged something on. I mean, they're going to be completely fresh or they're going to be stale. We'll see how they come out. They had an extra couple of days more than the Knicks going into tomorrow. But, Halliburton, Siakam, Nesmith, Turner, Nebhard, they have a ton of guys that they're going to throw at you. We're going to see how this team comes out, this Knicks team comes out. I mean, a home playoff series in the Eastern Conference Finals. If you had told me that at the beginning of the season, I think any one of us would have been like, come on, that's ridiculous.
To be honest, I thought there was a chance. I really did because I thought they could finish top two. I didn't think Cleveland was going to be as dominant. But, you're right, though, Jay.
With the way the season was playing out, no chance.
I thought he was going to lose his job. Here's the interesting – and when I talk about Tibbs, here's the interesting thing. Okay, the Pacers beat the Knicks last year in seven, right? As the Knicks were battling injuries, we saw, game 7 minutes, 40 minutes from McBride, 28 from Achiuwa, 27 from Burks. Remember him?
Yeah.
DiVincenzo played 41. They lost 130 to 109. They were beaten down. Knicks team just lacked answers, right? In fact, they've met eight times in the playoffs. Pacers have won five of the eight series, including the last three. And overall, 26 games to 22 games in the playoffs. And the Pacers also weren't complete last year because Mathurin, who's their sixth man.
Right.
It gives them yet another guy. This series, as much as Knicks fans are like, oh, yay, cakewalk, we get Indiana. I think they're happy because you got the home series. But Indiana is a pretty complete team. And any given night, any of those six guys could lead them in scoring. There's nobody to key on. Nemhard can do it. Like you said, you named all the guys. Nesmith, all the guys. And Mathurin off the bench. Right, Kevin? I mean, I don't see a weakness from this team that you look at, say, we have to exploit this matchup.
You look at the top eight in the playoff series so far. Halliburton is the worst shooting percentage at 47%. Mathurin's the only other guy under 50. Everybody else, Siakam, Turner, Nemhard, Nesmith, and McConnell are all over, and Obi Toppin, our old friend, they're all over 50%. They're all shooting very well in the playoffs. It's a deep team. They don't rely on just one guy. And even you get the crunch time. Take away Siakam, who's shooting about two-thirds on the free throws. Everybody else is at least 80%, going towards 90%. This is a team that is just fundamentally sound. They're going to make their baskets. They're going to make their free throws. They don't rely on the three solely. You know, they work the way for good shots. You know, this is and the Knicks don't rely on the three either. I mean, you know, this is going to be as close as possible, I think, to almost what we were used to a little bit more, where you're not just coming down and chucking up threes.
Yeah. The one point I'll make, so the Pacers are averaging about 30 assists a game in the playoffs.
Yeah.
They share the ball very well, okay? They also, like, the Knicks have two of the top 19 playoff scorers, okay? You have Brunson, who's six. You got Cat, who's 19. Indiana has number 23, 26, 29, 38, and 39, okay?
Yeah.
It is all consistent all the way through. They average 117.7 a game, second in the NBA playoffs. Knicks are averaging 106.8. So for the Knicks to win this, they got to keep the games, you're going to laugh at me, Gino, between about 106 and 112. That's where they have to – it sounds so stupid that I'm saying that, but that's where it has to be. Because the Pacers are shooting 50% from the floor. The Knicks are shooting 44% from the floor. Granted, they played different teams, but it wasn't like Cleveland soft. They just had some injuries. Milwaukee also faced some injuries, but the Knicks also, you know, finished off Boston without Tatum. So, I mean, you know, not that they weren't up in the series, not that they weren't going to win it, but, you know, everybody gets their breaks. The weakness on Indiana that I see, offensive rebounding. They're averaging less than 7 a game. They're the only team under 10 in the playoffs left, right? They're the only team that played in the playoffs at all, actually, that had less than 10 offensive rebounds a game. But part of that's because they're shooting 50.1% from the floor. So we don't know how it's going to be. It's going to be Cat against Turner or Mitchell Robinson against Turner. That's going to be the key. And their leading rebound has been Nesmith. He's averaging 6.5. Yeah. He's almost like a Josh Hart type player. So, which we're used to sometimes seeing him lead the way. These two teams are kind of a microcosm a little bit. Just one team plays a little faster than the other. I think it's going to be really highly competitive, G. I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm looking at.
I agree. I think this is going to be a very competitive series.
The one thing, and just a stat, and I showed it to Kev last night, we were all together. Jalen Brunson, remember, he took the $113 million off the top of his contract so that the Knicks could bring in Bridges and Cat. This guy deserves a lot of credit for being there, for sacrificing and selflessness, which you don't see that often in professional sports in this day and age, especially from a young player. So I thought that that's giving the Knicks a shot. If Cat doesn't play big, they won't win. Cat's got to outplay Turner. It's not really – and he's got to outplay him relatively consistently. He's got to out-rebound him, which shouldn't be a problem, but he's also going to have to outscore him on a regular basis and keep Turner where he's not shooting 65% from the floor. I think that's the key to the series for this team.
Okay. This is a series. I think the Knicks have the best player on the court in Brunson. And like you said, Cat is the difference maker. If Cat has the big series, and I wrote this down too, Darren, not just, you know, we think too much alike. We always do.
We've watched sports too long together.
Cat is the difference maker in the series. If Cat has a above average series for him, the Knicks win this. No doubt about it.
And you could tell that we all are on the same page because I wrote down for them to win, Brunson has to be the best player on the floor and Cat has to be the second best player on the floor. Right there. So, you know, that's it. Halliburton could be the second best player on the floor. But if Cat isn't the third best player in this series, they're going to have an issue. And I completely agree with that. That being said, the odds makers have the Knicks installed at -145 to win the series. The Pacers are +125 to win this series. Doesn't matter the games right now. It's just straight out right on. If you want the Knicks, it's -145 on the money line to win the series. That being said, I'm liking the Knicks. I think I don't know how Listen, I think there is a way that this could go less than seven. I think it's going to go seven. The way they played against Boston. Yeah, I know. Listen, we're all thinking the same way here.
You have three picks of the Knicks in seven. Here you go.
That's the way I see it. I think it's New York in seven.
New York in seven.
I also same way. New York in seven. All right. We're all so all three of us have the same analysis after all this watching. Cat's got to play big, and the Knicks are going to win in seven. Okay.
Okay. So
this in 12 seconds.
All right. But here you go. So I'll give you the question. Right.
Here
it comes. If they lose this series, what is the disappointment level? From the city, it's going to be a mess. But where is the disappointment level at this point? Is this they need to get to the finals or bust at this point?
For me, yeah, because it's home. Because they're the home team, I think they have to win this series. Because Indiana's taken them out the last three times, I think they have to kind of turn the tide on Indiana. Because they have the best player on the court, I think they have to find a way to do it. Because they have the best big man on the court, I think they have to find a way to do it. Because they went out and got two wings that are supposed to be able to defend Siakam and defend Halliburton and defend them hard. I think they have to find a way to do it. This team was built for this moment. If they don't find a way to win this moment, they're not going to be good enough. They're not going to be able to be good enough to beat a complete Cleveland team or a complete Indiana team. That means that there's something missing. I think that this has to be the year that they get past. I think it's a huge disappointment. I went on way too long. Kev?
No.
I'll make it easy. Ditto.
So I agree also. And for me, and I said this last round, for me, the doors have opened for the way to get to the finals this year. Yeah. And if you don't get there now, this is a major problem. Okay.
And for the NBA, you have a one seed, you have a six seed, a three seed, and a four seed. You're not going to get these opportunities that often where you'd have non ones and twos getting to the final that often.
Yep.
So yeah, this is a bit of an outlier for a 3-4 to meet.
I will tell you this. If they lose a close game seven, I'm not going to be happy. I think we will learn to figure out a way to live with it. But if they were to lose this in less than seven, this is a disaster at this point, because the opportunities of getting through teams like this doesn't happen that often. And this is when they need to capitalize. This is it. I'm not saying it's going to be easy to get past Indiana. That's not what I'm saying. But they got to find a way to get through this. They really do. They have to get to the finals.
They can't get down 20-plus.
Nope.
Against this team.
Nope.
Indiana's got too many weapons. Indiana will make sure they find the hot player. Somebody will step up for them and take care of business and score enough points so that they thwart any sort of major Knick rally. This is not going to be the Celtics coming down and chucking up threes and keep them in the game. They can't go down 20.
Okay.
And I think that the Knicks are going to get a split in the first two, and I think they're going to have to win in Indiana to win this series.
Okay. All right. Yep. Out west, OKC is playing Minnesota. Actually, game one is going on as we speak right now. Game seven was Sunday when OKC beat Denver by 28. And again, I'm sorry, by 32, excuse me. And Darren, exactly what you said. No, built up a series that it gets to a seventh game, and then the seventh game is just, non-competitive as it comes down the stretch. So,
yeah, you sit there and you watch it, and Denver, the game's real close late in the second quarter, and all of a sudden Denver just trying to force feed Jokic, and they can't get him the ball. It's just lazy entry after lazy entry after lazy entry, which they allow during the regular season, but in the playoffs they don't. And it's like nobody knows how to pass, or Jokic doesn't know how to fend off. All of a sudden, a two-point game became a 13-point game in like a minute and a half. And, there was nothing to watch after that. I mean, Denver has some good players. They really do. Gordon didn't play, but that wasn't the reason that they lost by 32. They just got dominated.
Yeah.
And, again, I turned it off. There's nothing to watch here. This is boring. It's a boring sport when it's not your team involved.
I agree.
So it's SGA versus the Ant-Man. Who are we liking, guys?
Well, I'll start. This is similar to the other series. OKC averages 117 points a game. Minnesota averages 108, okay? So Minnesota more on the Knick level. OKC more of the Indianapolis level, Indiana level. You got the two best young stars in the West going against each other. OKC's better at forcing turnovers. They're better at attacking the offensive glass. OKC is not as good a shooting team as Minnesota, but they both share the ball really well. I just think OKC's got a little bit more depth. Randall's been great, by the way, in Minnesota. And the question now I have to ask, because when Randall was here, the thing was he disappears in the fourth quarter. Now Cat disappears in the fourth quarter. Is it just the style that Tibbs calls in the fourth quarter where the bigs don't get touches? Or is it really – or is Brunson just hold it too long? I'm not really sure what it is, because Randall's not having a problem in the fourth quarter. In the Western players, I think this is going to come down to secondary players. It's just a thought. I don't know what you guys think about that. I think that Jalen Williams and Randall will be major factors. I think Caruso also a major factor with Naz Reid. I think OKC wins this in six. I just think they're a little bit better. I think they find a way to get through. I'm rooting for Minnesota, but I think OKC wins the series, guys. Kev,
hey, we got a little difference here.
Okay,
yep. A lot of the same points that you just made. I agree with a lot of that. I think Minnesota, taking advantage of Curry's injury, they were able to beat Golden State so easily. And OKC had a war with Denver for seven games. I think that gives Minnesota the advantage to get one of these two in OKC. I think Minnesota still goes eight deep as well. You know, it's not like they are reliant on just two guys. You know, they do have contributions from other players other than just Edwards and Randall. You know, Gobert averages almost a double-double in the middle there. I think some of it's going to come down to how the referees call the series. You know, my son watches more of the NBA than anybody else, and I asked him his opinion, and he says it depends on what the referees do with SGA. He compared SGA a little bit to Houston Rockets era James Harden and the fact that he's able to draw fouls that you question, how is that a foul? You know, whether it's a late kicking out or, you know, a phantom call that somehow, some way gets called in favor of SGA. If the referees keep this relatively balanced calling the fouls, and I think, you know, he also mentioned that, you know, OKC also felt like they played very aggressive defense at times in Denver, where it was almost, you can't call everything. And they let him get away with it a little bit. If the referees keep this pretty balanced between the two teams, I think Minnesota takes advantage of OKC going seven. I think they steal one of these two games in OKC, and I think Minnesota wins in six.
Wow. I like OKC. I think you guys brought up all the relative points. I think it goes seven. I think it goes back and forth this series. I think you may get a split here, and then you'll get a split the next two, and we're going to go back and forth. I think OKC in seven. You know, if the Knicks win, they're going to see one of their old friends, whether it's Hartenstein, whether it's Randall. We're going to see somebody coming back to the Garden. So that will make it a little interesting when we get there. I like OKC in seven. That's how I'm going.
By the way, Randall already has 20 in the first half of game one. Yeah, you know, I'm just saying. I mean, but Anthony did roll. Edwards did roll his ankle early on. I'm not even sure if he got back in yet.
I don't think he's back out yet.
Okay.
All right, so then we'll head over to the NHL. We'll talk about the playoffs there. So Edmonton took out Las Vegas in five. Dallas takes out Winnipeg in six. So Edmonton will play Dallas in the West. And in the East, Carolina took care of Washington in five. Took seven, and Florida took out Toronto 6-1 on Sunday. Darren, start it up wherever you want to go.
Well, I mean, to be honest, most of the NHL game sevens were really all the NHL game sevens were really good until this one. And this one was really good for about a period and a half. And then all of a sudden they scored three goals in about 6 minutes and it was pretty much over. You know, Toronto, and I showed Kev the stat last night. So Gino, you're going to love this one. because this tells you everything you need to know about the Toronto Maple Leafs before we go into the series. Since the 2004-2005 lockout, Buffalo has won four playoff series and Toronto has won two. Buffalo hasn't made the postseason in 14 years.
Wow.
So the core four for Toronto.
Wow.
I don't know if you could have a more disappointing core four than when Toronto was put forth, okay? Wow. And, you know, listen, did I expect that they were going to beat Florida the other night? No, I didn't think there was any chance because it's Toronto, and they don't do it despite all the talent they have out there. I don't, you know, Bob's a better goalie than Wall, and they didn't go back to Stolarz, which I would have done actually for game seven. So I was a little, actually game six, which I was a little surprised at. But the game wasn't what really worth talking about because Florida just dominated. The other three series, pretty well in control. I mean, the Dallas-Winnipeg series was kind of a war, but Dallas played a war in the first series against Colorado, too. They're easily the most tested team in this tournament right now, them and Florida on each side, because Florida had to play Tampa. And then had to play the seven games against Toronto. But we get to the East and we get Carolina, Florida, which right now Florida's up 3-1 in the second period of game one, I should say. Mm-hmm. I think Carolina's looked great the whole playoffs, all series long. They just look fast. They're forechecking. They're kill penalties outstanding. Anderson coming into this game had a goals against of 1.36. I mean, you know, you don't really lose games when your goals against is 1.36. Team is complete. Bob, on the other hand, his goals against is 2.31, and they played against Tampa and, you know they played against really good teams. They played against Tampa and Toronto, so it's not like they've been bad. Svechnikov's been the guy for Carolina with the goals. Bennett's been the leading goal scorer for Florida, which you don't expect, but they've had everybody contributing on both squads. When I break this thing down, I think Carolina is just a little bit better. I think that their forecheck is going to get the best of Florida when it all gets goes down to the end, and I think that Carolina is going to win this one in seven. I think these are the two best teams in the East going at it, and I think Carolina finds a way back to the Cup. Kev, thoughts?
No, this is a – you feel like when you talk about Florida and Carolina, you feel like you're talking almost about the same team half the time. You know, they're – gritty guys, you know, they've got good goaltending. And you can say that this about almost any NHL series, but it's going to come down to which team gets better goaltending. And we've seen Bobrovsky and Anderson both be able to play lights out in the series. And similar to, I think this goes seven. I think Florida somehow, some way finds a way. They've played a little bit tougher stretch here. I mean, Carolina had the Devils in the first round. And they got by Washington, which I thought was a good team. Florida's had a little bit more of the battle, you know, especially last series against Toronto. But I think Florida just being a little bit more battle-tested, I think they got to find a way to win this in seven.
I'm going Carolina in seven. And this is where I chose to go with this. So Carolina has played the least amount of teams of the four teams that are left. They only played 10 games so far. I think they're a little bit more rested than Florida. Florida's played 12. I'm taking Carolina in seven. Out west, I'm going the same way with my rest theory. Edmonton has played 11 games. Dallas has played 13. They played the most out of the four teams. I'm taking Edmonton, and I actually think this is Edmonton in five out west.
Kev,
yeah, I think. You know, Edmonton, this playoffs has shown that they can actually play a little defense also. I mean, that game five, 1-0 overtime win to beat Vegas. If they can play any sort of defense, you know that Dreisaitl and McDavid are going to score, no problem. They're going to get theirs eventually. Dallas has been gritty the whole playoff run here. But I think the Oilers are going to do something here and win this. I think it's going to go seven. But I see Edmonton winning this in seven.
Okay.
Okay, so you guys know I pick against Edmonton in every series.
Yes, we do.
And you know, this time, the real big difference for me in this series is Ottinger. I just think he's better than Skinner. And I think he's a lot better than Skinner. And as great as Dreisaitl and McDavid are, and they each have 17 points, and Bouchard's been great at the blue line, and Nugent Hopkins and Hyman, all these guys are fucking gifted. Excuse my language. The leading scorer of the playoffs, even though he's played a couple more games, is Rantanen. He's got 19 points, 9 goals, 10 assists. I think that Dallas does enough. And it's not because I have my anti-Edmonton bias. I think Dallas wins in six. I just think that they're a little bit better. And if they could, you know, I think they've already played as similar a team as to Edmonton as you're going to play when they beat Colorado. I think they've already seen it. Okay. And I think Colorado's a little better defensively than Edmonton, even though Edmonton, like you said, has stepped up defensively. They have two shutouts in the playoffs. It's not like they haven't done it. So I think that I'm going to take Dallas. I picked, but when the playoffs started, I said Carolina-Dallas. I'm not going away from it now. I'm going to say Carolina-Dallas. So I'll take Dallas in six. And that's our NHL wrap-up.
All right. We're going to head over to the PGA. PGA Championship was this Sunday. Scottie Scheffler wins it by 5 strokes in a, I'm going to call it a semi-dominant fashion. He wound up at minus 11. It's the second leg of his career Grand Slam. He's got 2 Masters wins in there. He's the third player to capture 3 majors and 15 tour wins before the age of 29. The other two, Jack and Tiger. So, yeah. He was up, and then Rahm was 5 back to start that final round. He gave him a run. He was tied as he hit the back, and he then finished 7 back, had a couple of bad holes on the back nine. Once Rahm kind of faded, and Kev, you tell me if you think, once Rahm kind of faded a little bit, I think Scheffler was on cruise control. I think he basically knew nobody else was going to catch him. Scottie Scheffler wins the PGA. Kev?
Oh, it's a great redemption story. You know, last year, here's Scottie getting arrested at the PGA. He comes out of jail, turns his life around, and comes back and wins the PGA this year. Yeah, it says with tongue firmly in cheek there.
The Kentucky militia had to take him out last year. Anyway.
Yep. But no, before the tournament started, Scheffler could have been very easily picked by any one of us. I think one of the nice things I think is that the PGA, we almost have to rethink it, because now that it's in May, it's not the end of the season. It's not when people and players are sort of done. Mm-hmm. Now it's the second major of the year. Guys are still trying to get in form, stay in form. You still have the U.S. Open and the Open Championship coming up in June and July. So I think, you got a little different feeling. And I think that caught me with some of my picks from last week. I don't want to talk about those too much. But like you said, I think Scottie, he had such a great third round to give himself a big lead. The amazing thing, to me is watching the broadcast on Friday. And here's Scottie. He was 2 under for the day, 4 under for the tournament, 4 shots back. And the announcer, I think Scottie feels like he's a little out of sorts today. There were 150 other golfers who would love to have been out of sorts.
Out of sorts. Minus
2. 4 under and 4 back on Friday afternoon at the PGA or any major. I mean, come on. He won the tournament on Saturday. Sunday, he didn't. I don't think he really wavered too much on the front nine on Sunday. Rahm made a great comeback, I thought, the front nine, and then Rahm fell apart. I mean, and Scottie played a great back nine. But like I said, I don't think it was so much Scottie coming back down to everybody else. Rahm made the charge and then ran out of gas and fell back. And nobody else was coming to Scottie.
Nope.
Darren?
Yeah, I mean, so the guy was Jonathan Vegas that just jumped out on Thursday and Friday that we all picked and thought that Jonathan Vegas had a real chance in this tournament. Nobody picked Jonathan Vegas, maybe the Vegas family. Rory barely makes the cut, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Shane Lowry, Brooks Koepka, Ricky Fowler, Jason Day, Patrick Cantlay, Zalatoris, Justin Thomas, Oberg, Spieth, Reed, Matsuyama, Cam Smith, Justin Rose, they all missed the cut. The guys on the leaderboard in the first 2 days outside of Scheffler was mysterious at the very, very least. And Quail Hollow seemed to have the players off balance. It was the Saturday afternoon back nine that kind of turned it around. The match, the tournament's closed. There's a bunch of guys within a stroke or two. A lot of guys hanging around minus 5, minus 6, minus 7. And then all of a sudden, Scottie shoots the 32 in the back. and gets out of there at minus 11. And what looked like it was going to be a one-stroke lead all of a sudden becomes a four-stroke lead going into the last day. And then Noren falls apart. He obviously the moment was a little too big for him playing in that final pairing with Scotty. And, you know, DeChambeau showed a couple of signs real early on that he was going to try to make a run, but he couldn't put it together. Like you guys said about Rahm, same thing. And Scotty really just kind of coasted home easily with a 71 par on the in the final round and never really a threat. And, you know, you want to see a better leaderboard, you know, nothing against Poston and all these other guys. You want to see, like, more exciting guys that make a run, but the course got the better of all these guys. PGA, congrats. Scottie Scheffler, best player in the world. I don't even think it's a debate. I mean, I think Rory's closest, but I don't think he's that close. If Scottie's playing his game, I don't think anybody beats Scottie.
Scottie's yeah. one, Rory's two.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. No doubt. It's not one and 1A, though. It's one and two now.
It's one, it's two, and then three. Three. I think there's a gap down to three, but
well, here's the funny part. If you ever see the movie Moneyball, and you see, you know, when Brad Pitt's explaining how their situation, that's how Kevin's hands were right now. There's the good teams, there's the rich teams, there's the poor teams, there's 30 feet of crap,
and then there's
Oakland A's. That's kind of where it is. The third best player, whether you think it's Schauffele or you think whoever it may be, Justin, whatever it might Bryson. Be for a particular tournament, they need to play perfectly. And these guys both need to be off in order to win. And that's kind of where you feel like it's going to be for the last two tournaments. Of course, always the Open Championship's always a little unpredictable with weather and stuff. So we'll see what happens there. But, again, congrats. Redemption Tour. Scotty Scheffler out of prison.
And one of the bets I gave you last week actually did hit. Bryson and Scheffler to both finish in the top 10 at plus 175. So that was the only one of the bets I gave you that actually hit.
Well, I thought Oberg was going to win it. So there you go. Yeah.
All right. So we will move over now to the Preakness, where we had a winner also. The 150th running of the Preakness Journalism wins. He wins by a half a length. He made up five lengths in the final 1/8 of a mile. Darren will get into it. Journalism paid $4. The Exacta paid $17.
No, trifecta, 33 because we play $2 exact. 34. We play $2 exact this year.
Yeah. Trifecta paid $74 and the Superfecta paid $303. Darren, talk to me about the Preakness.
All right. Interesting race in a lot of ways, okay? Journalism ran about as impressive a stretch run as you could run with the physicality that happened at the top of the stretch. You think he's done, and he just finds a way. But I'm going to start it off before we get to that. I'm watching the race with my dad, you know, and a bunch of other people that are around. And I'm looking at Gosker, because I bet Gosker. I told you guys he was a horse I liked in the stalking phase that I thought could get in. And all of a sudden, he drops from 19-1 to 14-1. And I'm like, and nobody's talking about it, but that's a lot of money to go down. You know, from 19-1 to 14-1, like late, like with a minute to go. I'm like, what happened? Ended up going off of 15. But nonetheless, I'm like, okay. I'm like, Pop, someone's liking Gosker is what I'm saying right there. Besides me, someone's liking Gosker. So race comes out. Clever again, the 8 comes out. And I thought the 1 was going to be the one that set the pace. You know, he chose to sit back, you know. So they went with eight, Clever again, goal-oriented the 1, kind of sat back in third. Gosker actually went out with him. And Clever again kind of controlled the pace of this race. And it wasn't fast, it wasn't slow. It was like 23, 46, and 6 at the half. So you're saying, okay, you know, you gotta stay close. It's not they're not walking at all, but they're not running 45 and change. Yeah. No one's trying to blitz it, and no one's trying to steal it. It's somewhere in the middle. I thought that Rispoli did a nice job keeping Journalism kind of, you know, he kept nudging them along a little bit to stay there. And all of a sudden, we start going around and we get to the top of the stretch. And this is where the excitement is. Now, you're sitting there looking at Rispoli, and they commented on the race afterwards about, oh, smart move, gutsy move. If that was a regular 6th race at Belmont, he'd be suspended for the move he made. There wasn't that much room. There was a spot. There was a spot when he's making the turn to go up the rail. But all of a sudden, Clever again slides inside. Takes it away. Goal-oriented. It was only run twice at this point. Flavien Prat can't control this horse either. He's leading in. So now Rispoli's got nowhere to go. The jockeys are elbowing each other. They're literally elbowing. Okay? It's physical. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, and journalism starts the contact, in my opinion. But then, you know, the one goal-oriented come veering into him. And he knocks into the eight. And now the eight, who was tiring already, just checks up. It's over for him. And you're saying journalism doesn't fall down, neither does goal-oriented. And Gosker's running, and Larry Collins had a great call, by the way. Great call. He's running, Gosker's running the race of his life. And he's so far out. You're like, you know, you can't believe it. And all of a sudden I'm looking and I'm like, he's gaining. Journalism regains his footing and he's gaining. And he's gaining. I'm like, Dad, he's gonna catch him. And all of a sudden, Collins at the end is just like, he might catch him. And he does. He catches him basically at the wire. This is a dangerous move by Rispoli. I wouldn't be surprised if in the Belmont they decide not to let Rispoli drive or ride him, because that was a bit of a dangerous move. I think, honestly, Kev, if we're watching claimers or an allowance at Belmont or Aqueduct in the fifth or sixth race, there's a suspension there, I think. I don't know what you thought.
There could be. I mean, you know, there's no room there. I mean, he forced his way in there. Gutsy, brave, dangerous, you know, whichever way you lean, you can use any of these adjectives. You know, he fought through so much traffic. The fact that he got through there and got out in front of those horses, but the way Gosker was so far in front, it sure seemed like it was 9-2-7 to the wire. And the fact that journalism had this other gear once he got clear. And the stretch run, I mean, that's one of the most impressive stretch runs I've ever seen in a horse race.
It was wild. It really was. It was something that you can't, you don't see very often. If you see it once every 3-4 years, a stretch run like that, it's a big deal. That's how impressive it was.
I mean, it was.
Think if this was another quarter of a mile longer, a quarter of a mile longer. He may have won by 4 or 5 lengths the way he took off. I mean, he took off like a freaking bullet at that point.
Son of Curlin. You know, the bloodlines are there. The mare, I'm blanking on the name, was bred for distance. Horse is supposed to be run forever. I'm supposed to be able to run forever. And did. Sandman, you know, he's been bet very heavy both first two races. No excuse in this one. Got pace. Had the center of the track to himself. Had second place for a minute. Then journalism passed him. And he never really made a move on Gosker. And you got to give Gosker credit. I mean, a great run by a 15-1 shot coming down there to finish second. But, wow. Pratt also has to be considered as a bit of a, you know, lack of control of his horse as well in that race. So it wasn't just Rispoli, but it was a hellacious finish. I don't know how else to put it. That was wild. And now we have the Belmont at Saratoga set up for the two horses that had the stretch run against each other in the Belmont going again against each other. Now you're going to have a horse that's got 5 weeks rest against a horse with 3 weeks rest. So it's going to be a little bit different there. Plus, Baeza will be back, and you saw the way that horse closed like a freight train.
Yeah.
So the Belmont, and again, they haven't given us all the horses yet, but the Belmont should have a really exciting three horses minimum in there that are going to make a run. So we might get something out of this. Obviously, you always want the Triple Crown, but both stretch finishes in the Derby and obviously in the Preakness have been outstanding, guys.
Yep. I mean, I thought, you know, journalism was the best horse in the Kentucky Derby. I'll still believe that. Sovereignty had the trip. And I think this race, you know, let's be honest, Gosker had the trip he wanted. And this time, journalism was able to overtake the leader. He couldn't in the Derby. He did in the Preakness. And, you know, sets up for a terrific finish of the Triple Crown races at the Belmont.
As long as we get both horses in the race.
Yep.
Well, I mean, no doubt.
For
Sovereignty, journalism, they shipped him up there. They're going to see how he's feeling. If they feel like he's training well, he's going to run, they said.
And you figured. And you feel like you get a couple of other horses in there. Repley's horse who was scratched to the Derby.
Not Grande. Grande was the other horse scratched.
Grande was scratched.
Was that Ripley?
Yeah.
That was Ripley. Okay, yeah. He was scratched. He should be there.
He should be there, the Belmont also. So, you know, you've got four or five real contenders here.
Yeah, you're never going to see a huge field in the Belmont. I think we're lucky if we get 7 to 8. But I think that you're going to have three with a real shot here at least.
Oh, what, they're going 10 furlongs here, mile and a quarter?
Yeah, they're going a mile and a quarter here.
It's not the mile and a half at the Belmont because they're up in Saratoga, so I think that might attract another horse or two. I think you're running in Saratoga, which I think is a step up than Belmont, just as a racetrack, as an atmosphere.
It's the number one track in the country, yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to attract another horse or two in there that you might not get at the Belmont. So, you know, I'm hoping to see a field of 10.
I would like to see it. We usually don't for the Belmont, but you're right. The Saratoga factor and the shorter race may attract a little bit more. Yeah, but listen, it should be a hell of a Belmont and setting up a really nice classic as well. And, yep. You know, when Travers weekend comes back around, we're going to see who likes the track at Saratoga, boys.
Yeah, Travers weekend, son.
Absolutely.
All right. Move over to some baseball. So yep. Before today, Yankees at 27-19, Mets at 29-19. I don't know what story you want to go to first, but I will tell you the story for me is Colorado is 8-39 before today, which is just wow.
Yeah.
We also had a second manager fired with Baltimore because they couldn't disappoint anymore if you tried. So Hyde got knocked out on Saturday. You know, a little crazy, but I guess let's start with the Subway Series a little bit just because, listen, it's May baseball. So if anyone's putting a lot of credence into this, you're crazy. But at the same point in time, both fan bases and both teams want to try to win the series. I thought it was a more important series for the Yankees for three reasons. Number one, they got swept last year. Number two, they were home. And number three, you had Fried and Rodon both on the hill. So I thought that they had to try to win the series. You had your two best pitchers going. You were at home, and the Mets embarrassed you last year. And the Yankees did find a way to win it, 2 out of 3. For the Mets, it was a bit of a tough weekend, I thought, Kev. I mean, Alonso, you know, that throwing error. I think the throw would have had to been perfect to get Dominguez. I think it was a little high. Dominguez gets under it. Obviously, yeah. You can't throw it away like that. But I think a lot of Mets fans were looking for Soto to kind of break out this weekend. And if anything, Clay Bellinger may have had his moment.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of cool. And it started Saturday. The Yankees lost this game. He had a perfect relay play to get Beatty at the plate. And yeah. it just was a great play in center field. Dominguez, the butcher, had a little trouble catching that fly ball. I mean, he may not have caught it anyway, but he's just flailing. He looks like he's lost when he's out there. And Bellinger plays a perfect carom, gets it to Volpe, who guns out. Beatty's foot kind of comes up as he's sliding in. Perfectly done by the Yankees. And then the Yankees up 4-2, and Bellinger hits the grand slam. Again, Yankee Stadium homer. It's not out of most stadiums, but it's out here. And it could be the moment where Bellinger starts to endear himself to the Yankee fan base. And Soto, I think, will have to wait a little bit longer. Listen, Soto's going to be fine. He's too good a hitter. But I thought that the Yankees did enough. The best game of the series was obviously the second game of the series where the Mets won it. But, you know, just a good hard-fought series for the most part. Kev?
Friday night was frustrating. That third inning. You know, and just to quickly Vivas leads off with a single. Grisham, the ground ball first. Alonso gets the out there. You pitch around Judge, just like you want to. So it's first and second, one out for McGill. Facing Bellinger. He couldn't have made a better pitch. Bellinger hits it off the end of the bat, the cue shot down to third. And because it's Mark Vientos down there who has to take his time to make sure he two hands and feels the ball and throws it first, Bellinger's safe. You know, it would have been a tough play for any third baseman to make. Vientos has no chance to make it, but, you know, he makes it great. But McGill makes the pitch, and he still winds up with a man on base. And then Goldschmidt comes up, makes another pitch, breaks his bat, the soft line drive-ish that, you know, sort of bounces in the dirt. Lindor fields it behind second. He throws wildly the first. Another run scores on the throwing error. So all of a sudden, you've got two runs in on two balls that never left the infield. And then later in the inning with one out, you know, you get the fly ball to right field that Soto lines up, and he winds up throwing five or six hopper into the plate. and Bellinger scores, if that's a one-hop throw, I mean, the throw is accurate. If that's a one-hopper to the plate, he's got Bellinger dead to rights. And then after that, you know, McGill's been out there for so long, he lost a couple to the end of the inning when he's got 35, 40 pitches in the inning, and it was 6-2, and the ball game was over. Or maybe it was 4-0 at that point, the final was 6-2. Well, it was just one of those frustrating innings. It was frustrating more than anything else.
Let's be honest. Soto's a left fielder that is going to play right field because he wants to play right field.
Exactly. But, I mean, there's no reason for him not to throw that ball.
Well, no, he's just not a great outfielder. He's an average outfielder at best.
Yeah. You know, the big problem right now is the Mets, you know, with the nice final here, they lost to Boston 2 straight to them. They've now lost 5 of the last 6. They haven't hit a home run since Brett Beatty last Tuesday night to beat Pittsburgh in the 7th inning. That's a full week. They're playing Yankee Stadium. You saw these pop fly balls. The wall scrape, the Mayhew's home run. That's out in Yankee Stadium at George Steinbrenner Field. I mean, and the Mets can't take advantage of this. Even tonight, they lose 2-0 to Boston. A couple of ones that, you know, sneak over the wall. And then, again, the Mets can't take advantage of it. They're just in a slump right now. Lindor going into tonight was 1-for-22 in the last 6. Soto, 254 in May, 246 overall. He hasn't gotten going yet. Pete now, including tonight, 8-for-51. No home runs in that stretch. 22 Ks, I think, over that stretch. When the top three are not hitting, and then you throw Nimmo down the last 4 games, he's 0-for-14. Nobody's hitting. They're not getting any big hits. The runners in scoring position is becoming a big deal. I think he's getting into their heads now. They can't pop one. They can't get a 3-run home run to take the pressure off. And the pitching has been pretty good during this little stretch here where they've been having trouble scoring. Let's see how they respond back here. I mean, they've got Crochet Wednesday, which is not going to be easy. Then they've got the off day. Maybe they can steal one against Crochet here and just get this little mini-funk turnaround here.
I mean, the interesting thing with them, again, like you're saying, with the offense is obviously not there. But tonight, when you look at Boston, you know, Buehler only went 2 1/3 because he got tossed.
Oh.
Cora got tossed too. So
no, that was terrible.
They didn't score off the whole pen. I mean, it's like that's the issue right now. And Philly has been playing great. So Philly has passed
them
right now,
taking them.
Despite Alvarado's 80-game PED suspension. Thank you, fantasy team. Just not a good offensive performance. Question for you. A little smiling from Soto over to the Yankee dugout during the series. Lindor looking over with a smile. Does that bother you at all?
I didn't notice it.
I did. I didn't notice the Soto one. I noticed the Lindor one when he made a big out where it looked like he got hit the ball well, but it was a changeup, and he kind of flew out to Judge in a big spot on, I think it was Sunday. And, you know, he kind of looked over to the dugout. I don't know. I want these guys to not like each other. I'm just that way. I don't know.
But, yeah, we're old. We like them not liking each other.
It's just better. I don't know. Baseball's better. I don't want the Yankees and the Red Sox to be friendly. You know, I don't know. It's the Mets. It's not the same thing. But, you know, it's close enough where, you know, I was just like, let's not be happy with each other.
Yep.
We'll see a little before or after the game. That's fine with me. G?
No, Judge still hitting 400 at this point, which is just ridiculous.
Hit a homer tonight,
I get the 16 home runs, the 36 RBIs. I get it. Hitting 400. I'm sorry. 16 home runs, 43 RBIs. Hitting 403 is just unbelievable right now.
So watching the game Sunday night, the one thing that stood out to me, and just watching him, and Gino was right about this a couple of years ago, Volpe is just not progressing here in year 3. He's just not. And there's a big spot. Bases are loaded. Brazoban's in. He's having trouble finding the zone. 3-0. Coney comes out, just says it. Got to make him throw you 3 strikes here. Throws the first pitch for a strike. Volpe proceeds to swing at the next 3 pitches, fouling 2 off and missing 1, none of them in the strike zone, which would have given the Yankees the lead and busted open a 2-2 game.
Yep.
And, first and foremost, you know, Volpe just doesn't seem to be progressing like we had hoped. But secondly, what is wrong with old school baseball every now and then? And taking the I don't understand why a walk is so poor in that situation with the bases loaded and one out. Yeah. And I don't know why you're not sitting there telling Volpe to put the bat on your goddamn shoulder till it's 3-2. I don't understand what they're doing right there. I didn't get it. I know he's got a lot of movement on his pitches, but, you know, I mean, you know, this is David Cone. This is not like someone that wasn't, like, really, really good during his career, or someone that didn't pitch in big spots and throw 150 pitches and would intentionally walk people without walking them just to face the guy he wanted to and throw the strikes where he needed to. I was just flabbergasted at Volpe's approach. I was flabbergasted at the Yankee approach. And actually kind of – and whoever was announcing with him, I forget because I don't pay attention, was like, well, it's not that era of baseball anymore. I'm like, what's wrong with the era of baseball taking the 3-2 lead? I don't know what I'm supposed to be watching. We think Volpe's going to hit a grand slam there? No. I'm praying for a walk when he goes up to the plate now.
And what's funny is that, you know, you almost have that guys are applauded for the three true outcome: the walk, the strikeout, or the home run.
Yeah.
They value on base. And yet, you know, when you have a chance, when you're 3-0 with a pitcher who can't throw strikes, like you said, Darren, nothing wrong with taking at least the first two.
You gotta.
So here's the one thing, right? This is similar to what you saw Volpe in the minors, but not similar, okay? He hit, you know, the last year he was in the minors, he hit 21 home runs, right?
Yep.
But he also stole 50 bases amongst, you know, double A and triple A. And that part of the game is not what we've gotten at this level. We want his on base to be 350, 360 and steal 45 bases. I don't need him on this lineup to hit 25 home runs. And, you know, when he comes out that rookie year and he goes 21 home runs and 24 stolen bases, oh, he's a 20-20 guy. Maybe not, but it's not the point. That's not what he showed you in the minors. We saw that he could hit 20 home runs in the minors, but the reason he got called up is because he stole 50 bases.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the team right now, you look at him right now. I mean, you say he's an adequate shortstop in Major League Baseball, but there's nothing where you sit there and say, wow, this kid is going to be special.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, now on the other side of the coin, when you look at the Mets and the kid's not playing every day, but you're sitting there, you still have that hope that Acuna could be something special. The bloom's off the rose right now for Volpe, unless he does some sort of massive turnaround. Because right now, Volpe's going to be a serviceable, adequate shortstop who's going to probably be a 15 to 20 home run guy and a 15 to 20 stolen base guy on a regular basis and hit 245 for you. And I don't need him batting fifth. We're going to do that. I need him batting eighth. I got to be honest.
And Darren, that little crop of middle infielders that we talked about with the Yankees, which was Volpe and Peraza and Cabrera, they've all been so-so. Not one of them broke through. And we kind of hoped that one of them, even if it could have been Volpe, could have been Peraza, we kind of hoped one of them would break through, and none of them broke through.
Nope, you're right. Know?
And listen, I don't want to discount Volpe at this point to the nth degree, because he's still an adequate shortstop, but that's what he is.
He's good, but you were sitting there saying, you never thought he was going to be Derek Jeter. Anyone that thought that's crazy, no. But you thought that this could be the next really good player, young player for the Yankees, and it doesn't look like it's happening.
Agreed.
Just a point of parliamentary procedure, right?
I mean, you almost wonder if the Mets are going to feel the same way with Acuna. I mean, you know, shortstop is blocked with Lindor,
yeah.
But with Acuna, Jet Williams, Ronnie Mauricio, who's back healthy and playing at least in AAA, or any of these guys going to really make that breakthrough and claim that second base position, or move to center field and claim that center field position? You know, if one or two of them make it through, you know, so I think the Mets are going to be in the same position as the Yankees. You know, can one of these guys make that breakthrough?
You're 100% right. That's what we're going to be looking for.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Darren, let's move to the NFL. You had a couple
of quick baseball points.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. Alvarado, 80-game PEDs. We're doing that. Yep. A couple teams starting to play well. The Twins were on fire. They lost last night, but the Twins went from a team that looked like they were giving away the season to a team now that's up to 4.5 out behind Detroit, who's also still playing well, by the way. Phillies, like we said, Cardinals also playing well. Angels swept the Dodgers, and the Mariners swept the Pods, and the Pods lost again tonight. So each of those teams have lost 4 in a row right now. And a guy no one's talking about, we've mentioned this team, and they've hit the slump, the Oakland Athletics. Well, I'm sorry, the Athletics, my bad, Sacramento, whatever they are. But Jacob Wilson's hitting .343 with 5 homers and 26 ribbies. I mean, if anyone would have told me Jacob Wilson was going to be the hot-hitting young shortstop, I would have been like, who? And now the kid is tearing it up. Two other quick baseball points. Former Major League pitcher Danny Serafini accused of killing his father-in-law in Lake Tahoe in 2021. Also accused of having an affair with the nanny at some point. It goes to the trial starts this week. Jury selection underway. Ellie De La Cruz will officially pass Tony Gwynn in career Ks this month. Right now it's 434 to 422. But you know Ellie will pass him. And then in my little interesting baseball note, Richie Ashburn of the Phillies, okay, 1957. He hits a foul ball that strikes Alice Roth. Okay. While she's being carried off the field on a stretcher, he hits her again. What are the odds of the same woman getting hit twice by Richie Ashburn during the same at bat? I just thought that was an interesting stat. Kev?
I have two little things here for you that I found online. There have been two games in Major League Baseball history where a pitcher went 2 1/3 innings, allowed 12 base runners, and 11 earned runs. Both of them are Tanner Houck, and both of them are this year.
I did not know that.
That's great.
And this one that I found also, once I get it up here. Madison Bumgarner.
Yep.
Hit more grand slams than Prince Fielder in his career. Who had more inside the park home runs than Ricky Henderson. Who had fewer steals of home than Babe Ruth. Who had as many shutouts as Pedro Martinez. I mean, these are just things that just, you know. They're just funny. You know, some of us who love baseball and love the numbers of baseball just find this stuff like, wow.
Very, very, very funny.
Well, listen, I'll give you my favorite, which is over and over, and that's the only reason I remember it off the top of my head. In 1982, Ricky Henderson stole 130 bases, and that's not the best stat regarding his stolen bases. He was also caught 42 times, which means he attempted to steal 172 times in one single season.
It's amazing. It really is.
That's my favorite stat because I can only quote that stat.
One last quick point in baseball. It's a college baseball point. So Auburn has a kid named Andrew Dutton. He's a 50-year senior, and he coached first base all season. But in the last game of the season, they let him take in a bat. He hit a home run.
Yep.
Just something to point out. NFL, because you had brought it up before. We didn't talk about this last week. We skipped it. Derek Carr retired.
Yeah.
So now the Saints quarterback room, led by Spencer Rattler, with Sean and Jake Haener, those are the three guys that are fighting for quarterback reps. I guess they probably enter a sweepstakes that for Aaron Rodgers or one of the other quarterbacks that might want to get traded or dealt somewhere along the way. Derek Carr, only quarterback to have lost to 31 teams. He had 40,000 passing yards and no playoff wins. Only quarterback to do that as well. At the same time, Brock Purdy got a brand new contract this week, 5 years, $265 million. So big money for Brock, and they believe in him. The league says that if the Steelers had signed Aaron Rodgers, the Jet-Pittsburgh game would have been a primetime game week one because of the legacy
of
Aaron Rodgers with the Jets. It was almost like people saying, how come the Yankees didn't do anything for Soto? He was there 1 year. He's not a Yankee. Stop. And then the stat I kind of alluded to last week, but to watch all NFL games this year, you will need to spend $1,515.40 because you will have to purchase Sunday Ticket, YouTube TV, Peacock, Netflix, Amazon Prime, ESPN Plus, plus your taxes and fees. Gino?
Guilty.
Well, my wife shops, so she gets Amazon Prime. So that's
at least one less thing that you're already spending the money.
My wife's spending that money. I get the football as a privilege, as a benefit. But the other stuff, yeah,
it's crazy. So that's and with Christmas is like all streaming, and it still beat the NBA last year.
Yeah,
it's kind of crazy.
Still shouldn't be playing at Christmas.
No, especially last year, Wednesday, that was a joke.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. Not that it's much better on Thursday, but at least you can tolerate one game. They shouldn't be playing three. It's just ridiculous. But that's all I got, guys. Anything else for you guys?
Nope. I think we did a good job. I think we covered almost every sport.
We are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Darren here with Kevin here with Gino talking about the wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports, a wacky world where the Knicks somehow, by the grace of God, have taken over New York City again. Please download the podcast anywhere you can get a podcast, whether it be Spotify, iHeart, whatever you like. We post a lot on social. Like and share our stuff. Even if you don't like it, share it anyway and like it anyway. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.